This is Tidings, and I'm Hazel Kahn. Stephen F. Cohen and Katrina Vandenhuvel spoke in August 2019 at Canio's Books in Sag Harbor about U.S.-Russian relations. Stephen F. Cohen is Professor Emeritus of Politics at Princeton University, where he directed the Russian Studies Program, and Professor Emeritus of Russian Studies and History at New York University. Katrina Vandenhuvel is Editorial Director of The Nation. They are husband and wife, and together visited Russia for periods of time during the late Soviet era. Stephen F. Cohen's books include, most recently, War with Russia, From Putin and Ukraine to Trump and Russiagate. Here is Stephen F. Cohen.
The thesis of the book is we're in a new Cold War. I don't want to argue this with anybody any longer because I began saying it about 10, 15 years ago and everybody said it was crazy, but now it's generally accepted that we're in a new Cold War with Russia. I mean, but this is what's different. I think this Cold War is more dangerous than the one, looking around the room with a few exceptions, those of us in this room survived. Remember quite well. I think this one is more dangerous. Now, the reasons are spelled out in the book. I have one chapter called I Became Didactic and Decided to Add Them Up, but 10 reasons why this new Cold War is more dangerous than the one all of us except the young man here perhaps. And 10 reasons why, but I just want to mention a couple and let it go at that, and we will then discuss what you want. Stop and think that the political center of the Cold War we survived was in Berlin, a long way from Russia. Today it's right on Russia's borders, from the tiny Baltic countries of Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, right? Black Sea, down to the Black Sea, to Ukraine. This is Russia's borders. This Cold War is more dangerous. I give in the book 10 reasons, but I only want to mention two. One is that the previous Cold War, which we survived, had its political center in Berlin, a long way from Russia. This Cold War is right on Russia's borders, from the little Baltic countries all the way down to the Black Sea and Ukraine. So we are eyeball to eyeball, our military power, NATO, but NATO's run by the United States. The United States and Russia are geopolitically, literally, we can see each other. St. Petersburg is within artillery fire, not missile fire, artillery fire of NATO troops in the Baltic. So we are now like this, and this is dangerous. And you can imagine what could go wrong. What can go wrong does go wrong, right? Well, whose rule is that? Murphy's Law or somebody's law? But so I worry about that a lot, and I think that's what's different. The second thing that makes this different is that we counted on our leaders during the 40-year Cold War to escape potential nuclear crises. What's the classic example we lived through? Cuba, right? And it remains today the no-no. We never, ever, ever want to get into a situation with Russia, like Cuba, where either one side or both sides, having come eyeball to eyeball, both armed with nuclear weapons, the weapons, the missiles pointed at each other, the leaders have to back down. And it's hard for leaders to back down. Kennedy and Khrushchev did it because they were Kennedy and Khrushchev and because they had a secret agreement we didn't know about until many years later. But the point is that they saved us. It was very close. Imagine that happening today. All right, what's going on? We've utterly, irrationally demonized Putin. So any American president who decides to have serious negotiations with Putin is going to take a beating in this country for no good reason. What makes Putin worse than Khrushchev, who was a communist? I mean, this is a story in itself. But now we have another problem. Donald Trump.
That's a problem.
Now, I didn't vote for Trump, but he is the president, and he is the one, if we get into one of these Cuba-like situations, we have to count on to negotiate with Putin the way Khrushchev negotiated, Kennedy negotiated with Khrushchev to pull back. Will the establishment let Trump do that? Will you in this room? Will our newspapers? Somebody once said to Stalin, I think it was George Bernard Shaw, Soviet literature isn't so great. Stalin said, these are the only writers I got. This is the only president we got for now. for a while, like it or not. So if we get into this kind of situation, I worry, will Trump be empowered to do what will need to be done? Maybe make concessions. With all this Russiagate stuff and nonsense about him being a criminal agent, I really worry that if a crisis like this came, the president would not be fully empowered to negotiate with Putin a way out. So I think about that a lot. I start writing this book in the form of these broadcasts in 2013 when the Ukrainian crisis began. You all remember that, right? Maidan and all that. And then in the course of the 6 years from when I began the broadcast in the book and to publishing it earlier this year, what happened was what I start calling Intelgate. Intel, short for Intelligencegate. I began to think, not 100%, but enough to worry me, that what we have been calling Russiagate was cooked up by the American, and not only the American, intelligence services, as early possibly as 2015, but certainly by the summer of 2016. That is, this business that Trump was in cahoots with the Kremlin, and that he was somehow gonna, they had something on him, that we couldn't trust him, that he was a Putin puppet. You remember that? There was a lot of Putin puppetry going on. Hillary Clinton, during the debate, said, "You're a Putin puppet," and then Trump, with his usual elegance, said, "Not a puppet, not a puppet, not a puppet." I mean, it was unbelievable. But this is what had become part of American discourse. So this happened during the time that I wrote this book. So a chunk of the book, not a big chunk, but an ongoing theme, is what were the intelligence services doing in 2015 and 2016, in regard to Trump, but also to Russia. Because if they were off the reservation, and way off the reservation, in the sense that they were out to destroy a presidential candidate, not my candidate, not your candidate maybe, but any presidential candidate, something had gone wrong. And whatever had gone wrong now had become an enormous factor in American-Russian relations, that is, the relations between the two nuclear superpowers. So that's the theme of the book. What is it that the intelligence services did or didn't do? For example, about the Steele dossier. Do you remember that Steele dossier? Because I knew it stank the moment I had a look at it, the moment I got an early look at it. And I knew it was cooked up, but that isn't what was interesting. What was interesting to me is who cooked it up and why. And, you know, the American authorities, the FBI, acted on it and getting FISA warrants. I mean, it was clearly a fiction, but they went ahead and used it. So it's of great importance that we know how that came to be. So that's another thing. I lived from the late 70s to end of the 90s fairly frequently in Soviet Russia. Katrina was with me in the latter years of the Soviet Union. And we were close not only to a number of Soviet officials, but particularly to a fairly wide circle of Soviet dissidents, whom we socialized with a lot. As this Russiagate phenomenon began to unfold, I began to worry, and I began to write about it. And there's a few pieces in here about that. With a question mark, the extent to which Russiagate included practices that were really, really Soviet-like practices.
Soviet-like?
Soviet-like practices. The use of informers, the use of double agents, the Papandreou affair. You remember this case? I mean, the operation they ran against him was out of a Soviet KGB textbook. Holding people in prison without bail, as they did this woman who did nothing, Marina Butina. I think she's still in prison. These were practices that the Soviet authorities used to bring pressure on the dissident movement, and some of our friends were affected. So I began to talk to on the air with John Batchelor and to write about this worrisome echoing, if not repetition, of Soviet practices in our own democracy. And of course, I thought that a very bad thing. So that's another theme in the book.
That was Stephen F. Cohen, Professor Emeritus of Russian Studies at Princeton University and New York University, speaking in August 2019 at Caneo's Books in Sag Harbor. Professor Cohen was joined by his wife, Katrina Vandenhuvel.
As editorial director, longtime editor of The Nation, we were terribly saddened to lose our longtime editorial board member, Toni Morrison, this past week. And I just wanted to read a few lines of hers from our 150th anniversary issue. She wrote an extraordinary essay, "No place for self-pity, no room for fear." This is precisely the time when artists go to work. There is no time for despair, no place for self-pity, no need for silence, no room for fear. We speak, we write, we do language. That is how civilizations heal. I know the world is bruised and bleeding, and though it's important not to ignore its pain, it's also critical to refuse to succumb to its malevolence. And I thought those words made sense at this time, when I think all of us wake every morning with a sense of dread and despair, but also hope and history, hope about the new insurgent candidates. But my mission today is to speak and follow someone who has been called America's most controversial Russia expert by the Chronicle of Higher Education. And it has been a trip to live with the most controversial Russia expert in America, especially at a time when I would submit that liberals and progressives, many of them have seen resistance as feeding Russiagate. But to me, let me just begin personally. Steve and I lived in Moscow from 1985 to 1992, 93, 3 or 4 months a year. But one thing I have seen over these last years is that Cold Wars are bad for progressives, are bad for people who believe that we don't need to empower the war parties on both sides. We don't need these crazy bloated military budgets which steal and loot the resources needed to rebuild our country. And I think that that's the danger that I see at this moment looming large, because we're on a trajectory where some of you may or may not know that the new national defense strategy of this country is no longer counterterrorism, but it's to elevate Russia and China as this country's greatest, most dangerous enemies. And that is a recipe for endless Cold War. It also, and this comes from my experience in Moscow, and you see it here too, when you have Cold Wars, nationalist fervor rises. The space for dissent narrows. The room for those who speak in nonconformist ways narrows. And I've seen it used, Cold Wars used to suppress independent voices in both countries. I've worked with feminist groups, with independent publishers, independent journalists, and they tell me today, even as people protest in the streets of Moscow, and there will be elections, September 8th, regional elections, but it's much more difficult to dissent without repression. In this country, what really disturbs me is that those who take a different view from the conformist view, those who say, for example, oppose this new Cold War, are often smeared or labeled pro-Russian, pro-Putin, pro-Kremlin. There's someone I think you should know if you don't know about him, is a man named Ro Khanna. Do you know Ro Khanna?
Yes.
Representative from California. He's been very important in ensuring that Congress has brought back the War Powers Act, that it no longer abdicates its role in matters of war and peace. He, along with Bernie Sanders, has been at the forefront of trying to end the United States' complicity with this genocidal war in Yemen. But last year, The Hill newspaper, pretty pro, I don't know, pro-Hill, accused Ro of being duped by Russia and complicit in a Kremlin, quote, active measure. His offense, sponsoring eminently sensible legislation that prevented sending U.S. military aid flowing to Ukraine's neo-Nazi Azov battalions. This is crazy. So Putin puppet, Kremlin asset. Whatever you think of Tulsi Gabbard, and there are different views, it is wrong, it is just wrong to criticize her by equating her opposition to a new Cold War, and after all, she was in Hawaii in that very, very scary drill, which could have been a real nuclear drill, to equate her support for ending the Cold War, for ending endless wars, with being pro-Kremlin and pro-Assad. We've seen this game before. It's not a game. I say with humility, people in this room are old enough to remember when anti-war activists during the Vietnam War were, you know, baited and condemned as witting or unwitting tools of North Vietnam because their positions overlapped with the U.S. anti-war movement's positions overlapped with North Vietnam's. But also I've seen it because I was very proud to be editor of The Nation in the run-up to the war against Iraq, which we vigorously opposed, I think one of the greatest foreign policy disasters of the 20th century. And it's not pretty going against government policy, and many liberal media institutions collapsed. So let me just say for a second, journalistic media malpractice. There are many examples. But, you know, one of them is, as you may have noticed, it's sort of changed a little since the Mueller report, which I see is in the front window, which I love, has come out, well, since Mueller testified. But the valorization of former intelligence agents, of security chiefs, like the National Rehabilitation Tour, of Brennan, of Clapper. Clapper perjured himself twice before Congress, yet he's given a perch almost every evening on these cable shows to be a figure of moral rectitude. So I think this is really a misuse of our airwaves, a misuse of critical analysis that's needed. What strikes me, and I work with younger people, is that they've come to trust many of these people, these former security officials, as voices of conscience. And how can we forget that these are the very institutions which have, through our history, abused and violated civil rights, civil liberties, movements, civil rights movements, women's movement, dissident groups? So I worry that we have a generation, this may be shifting, we see it with maybe AOC, and what an outrage today about Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar and being refused entry to Israel. That's a different discussion. But I do see a generation raised to equate resistance to Trump with support for this new Cold War. Partly because of what Steve said, the demonization of Putin. Opposition to Trump should not be opposition to common sense. That is hard because you have to separate out principles. But I worry that this toxicity about Russia, the new Cold War, will endure beyond Trump. As I said, the national defense strategy is in place. And I think for progressives, we need to have a serious discussion, and I think it's coming to the forefront of this crazy presidential election, more discussion about the kind of foreign policy and national security. Not enough, but more discussion about what we need in terms of a policy of restraint and realism and dialogue and less posturing and triumphalism. There are, of course, wings within the Democratic Party, and I think Joe Biden, and I won't say more except that he will be a restorationist. And I think you could see in Warren and Sanders their problems with their foreign policy, but they will be something different. And I think Tulsi's voice is important in the debate as a voice against endless war, against regime change. I will finish by just, I mean, I do think sometimes, you know, what's the expression, a broken clock is right twice? When Trump talks about negotiations with North Korea, and he's impulsive and he's odious and there's so much narcissism, it's just got to cut through. But when the Democrats say he's weakening our national security because he's not supporting South Korea war games with the U.S., you got to wonder, no, you got to step back. When he says he wants to pull troops out of Afghanistan, he may not have a plan, but you don't say that he's, you know, Putin's puppet. You try to build on that, to find a way to support that for the sake of it, not for Trump. So I take heart in the fact that as we enter 2020, and in 2018 as well, Gallup poll showed that Russiagate didn't even rate among the top 25 or 30 issues. And I think that that's something to build on. As Steve warns in his book, this Cold War is more dangerous. And he didn't even talk about what we're witnessing. I mean, this fire at the nuclear plant, the nuclear missile plant in Russia, is largely, and he can speak to this more intelligently, but is a function of the arms race that has arisen as a result of this new Cold War. And it goes back to 2002 when John Bolton, under George W. Bush, led the way abolishing the ABM, so that the arms control infrastructure is unraveling. And to put that back into place is going to be very, very tough in this new Cold War atmosphere. I will end by saying I do believe we must protect our democratic institutions. Every country has meddled in everyone's election, you know, other countries' elections. But, you know, what Mitch McConnell is doing, I don't know what he's doing, blocking more voter security. We need to protect our voting systems, our democracy infrastructure. We should have learned that, by the way, in 2000 when this country suffered a coup when the Supreme Court selected George W. Bush. The Chads, hanging Chads, this and that, it is pathetic, our democracy infrastructure. We need global rules of the road around cyber, around hacking. We need to strengthen our electoral infrastructure, and we need to strengthen it. I think the Russia meddling and hacking is greatly overstated. I'm more concerned about a Supreme Court, about deep money, dark money, and voter suppression, which is being funded as tight as it can be as we sit here. So that's my concern. And I would just say, as editor of The Nation, I hope that we as, you know, whatever you are, I mean, you're common sense, humane, progressive, liberal, that you, you know, we have had a long history of adopting alternative views and unpopular stances, especially on matters of war and peace. I believe it's vital, particularly at this moment, to challenge the conventional wisdom, to foster rather than police the debate, foster rather than police, which happens too much on our corporate media. And I include in there, with all due respect, MSNBC, CNN, I'm not talking about Fox. So I think it's important to listen to those rather than vilify those who advocate and pursue better relations with Russia. And while arguing that both the U.S. and Russia have serious interest in maintaining a working relationship, I believe that may not be popular. It also isn't radical. It's simply, in my view, sober realism. Thank you.
That was Katrina Vandenheuvel of The Nation, speaking in August 2019 at Canyon's Books in Sag Harbor. A questioner asked why she should not be concerned about the numerous accusations about Putin and Trump. Professor Cohen and Katrina Vandenheuvel responded.
Well, I don't think you should put it down.
Okay.
I mean, you should evaluate it.
All right.
I mean, I don't simply say, oh, not going to pay attention. But what I find, is that most of these allegations have no factual basis, or, and this is the important fact, they're fairly commonplace in the dirty world of politics, including international politics. So, Trump, for example, just to take one example, was much berated for his efforts to build a Trump Tower hotel in Moscow. Mm-hmm. Right. That's a fact, right? And he wanted to do so going back before I even know. It was a notion he had decades ago. Okay, what do we make of that? Well, you begin with remembering that about 160 major American corporations are doing business in Russia. And that Trump is the only major international hotel guy who doesn't have a hotel in Moscow. So, if you were going to Moscow and you asked us, where should I stay? And you said, I'd like to stay at some franchise I've heard of. We would say, well, would you like to stay at a Marriott? Would you like to stay at a Radisson? Would you like to stay at a, what's the motel chain that's there? But the point is that dozens, if not at least a dozen, Western hotelers have been in Moscow a long time. They deal with Russian oligarchs because Russian oligarchs control the Russian economy. So you could hardly fault Trump for anything than being inept.
Okay.
because he's the only one who didn't build. I mean, so where's the corruption here? So what you do with these allegations, or I do, is take a look at them and evaluate them. So let me give you one example that really has aggrieved me, because the guy got such a bad rap, but I don't like the guy. You all know this guy, General Michael Flynn. Mm-hmm. All right. So Trump appoints him National Security Advisor. Big job. And it turns out he had to leave because he made a call to the Russian ambassador at Trump's instructions. And then when the FBI asked him if he made the call, he lied about it. So he created what's called a, committed what's called a process crime. What's wrong with this story? Every American president, best I can tell, at least since Nixon and possibly since Eisenhower, had his national security guy immediately upon his election, but before he became president, get in touch with a ranking then Soviet and then Russian official. To do what? To say, there are a lot of crises between us. Do not make them worse, because we don't want to enter the White House in a crisis with Russia, and we will have a look at everything through fresh eyes. That is exactly word for word what Flynn told the Russian ambassador. Okay, the FBI asks him, did you talk to the Russian ambassador? Trump had told him, the same way Nixon told Kissinger, no one is to know about this. The president-elect told his man, tell no one about this. So Flynn was trapped. What should he have said to the FBI? Well, the first point is the FBI never should have asked the question. It was none of the FBI's business. But Flynn fibbed, because he felt that was his first duty as a military officer, his first loyalties to the commander-in-chief elect. So these are the kinds of things, when I hear these allegations, that I look into, and they either turn out to be fairly commonplace in the world of presidential politics and money, or they were reported and handled in this country in a way that was pretty distorted. And I only give Flynn as one example.
I wanted to respond very quickly to two of your questions. One is about journalists. Well, since it was founded 25, 30 years ago, the leading independent opposition newspaper in Moscow is called Novaya Gazeta, New Newspaper. It's where Anna Politkovskaya and several of the journalists who've been killed, assassinated, worked. If you speak to its editor, he will tell you that in the case of Anna Politkovskaya, she was doing reporting on torture and corruption in Chechnya during the war, and that it was most likely the Chechen government. Now, that doesn't mean that Putin hasn't created a culture of impunity, nor does it mean that these killings of journalists really began under Yeltsin. There were at least 300 documented, because they were investigating corruption and the looting of the country by oligarchs. So this has gone on. But Putin creating a culture of impunity, but the independent journalists will tell you that it's often regional overlords, it's regional corrupt officials. There is a gamut of people involved with these killings. And to just say Putin, Kremlin, is to simplify what is a very dangerous and ugly situation.
This is Tidings. We heard The Nation editor Katrina Vandenhuvel and Emeritus Professor of Russian Studies at Princeton and New York University, Stephen F. Cohen. They were recorded at Canyo's Books in Sag Harbor in August 2019. Stephen F. Cohen's books include Soviet Fates and Lost Alternatives, From Stalinism to the New Cold War, and Failed Crusade, America and the Tragedy of Post-Communist Russia, and most recently, War with Russia, From Putin and Ukraine to Trump and Russiagate. Professor Cohen's article, What We Still Do Not Know About Russiagate, is in the September 4th issue of The Nation magazine. Today's program was produced by Tony Ernst with the aid of Marianne Calendrill and Catherine Soka. I'm Hazel Kahn.